Москвам, а спива. В заграде сиди, свата параскева, а спива. Зо, ту дуа шум, ту дуа шум, зо, ту дуа шум, зо, ту ту дуа шум, дуа шум, зо, ту ту дуа шум. Зо, ту дуа шум, ту дуа шум, зо, ту дуа шум, зо, ту ту дуа шум, дуа шум, зо, ту ту дуа шум.
Welcome to Talking Earth. You're listening to KBO Portland 90.7 FM on your FM dial. And I have here in the studio with me Bill Tremblay, the author of seven collections of poems, including Crying in the Cheap Seats, Jill Mole, Shooting Script, and Magician's Hat, which most of you had the pleasure of listening to here on Talking Earth. And he has a new book out that I have not been able to acquire, unfortunately. We're airing this a little early, but hopefully the bookstores get in gear by the time this airs.
Patrick, it's my ninth book.
This is your ninth book?
Yes, this is my ninth book. And very different from the books that I've written in the 21st century, Shooting Script and Magician's Hat, in that it's, the usual kind of poem that we call a lyrical meditation. I think most people who are trying to write are writing lyrical meditations, brief poems, usually no more than one page or maybe a page and a half, in which the speaker of the poem ruminates, and in my case, the meditations are meditations on water because of the ditch that runs behind my house. In Fort Collins, Colorado. It's an irrigation canal, actually. And I did a little research. I found that the ditch was started in 1874 and was dug by hand by work gangs who just, dug a groove into the earth about 30 yards wide.
Wow.
I can imagine that it just took an exhausting amount of labor to, cart all that dirt in horse-drawn wagons. It was quite a feat. And it was done, it was commissioned by a man named Eaton, Benjamin Franklin Eaton, who went on to become governor of Colorado in later years. He has a town named after him about 20 miles or so out on the eastern plains, which was, the reason why he had it. He had the ditch dug to bring water out to his land. So, usually almost every day I take a walk by the ditch. You know, it really helps me settle down. It helps me to sort things out. I just love being there. I just sit on the banks and take out my notebook and start jotting down stuff. And, you know, mostly just what I see. But the whole thing is really, you know, in concert with another part of my life, which is not separate, and that is that I've become a practitioner of Tai Chi.
Wow. Did not know that.
Tai Chi Chuan. And doing Tai Chi is a form of meditation, really. And so the two things, in fact, they often become one. There's a place along the trail that follows parallel to the ditch, which widens out and flattens out. So oftentimes I'll do my exercise in the open air and in full view of the front range of the Rocky Mountains.
Wow, that's a nice place to be doing Tai Chi.
Yes.
I actually took Tai Chi for a while. Yeah, I got up to like a second degree brown belt, and then I kind of quit for various reasons.
Wow.
It's a very relaxing.
I tried Tai Chi a long time ago, 1980. But I was with a teacher who wanted me to become adept at Kung Fu.
Well, it kind of is slowed down Kung Fu, but so there's a variety of different aspects of it that can, it just depends who you're learning from, I think, is what's the, but it is about, you know, meditation too.
That I needed to learn, I began to learn, and one of them is patience.
That's something, you know, that's a virtue. I mean, for that,
the whole idea of the Tai Chi is the Chi, and the realization that whenever you have tension in your body, then you have a blockage in the flow of Chi. So you have to work on relaxation, or what the Chinese call sung, S-U-N-G,
sung, yeah,
where you settle your body in and you begin to find what they call your soft feet. In other words, just in a standing meditation, just your feet are really taking all your weight, and you're being able to develop what they call rootedness, so that all of your moves are rooted in the earth or even in the floor, and you have incredible stability in your moves.
Yes, that's yeah, another big thing with it. That's, I did not know that you were taking that. That makes, yeah, sense, though. I mean,
yeah. You know, and it has led me to, you know, certain realizations about myself and my relation to the world. You know, the thing that I've been working on is just the realization that the trees and the bushes and the flowers and you know, and the weeds and the water and the things that float in the water, including Canada geese and ducks and blue herons, are each, you know, I mean, Blake says it, you know, every bird that cuts the airy way contains an infinity of delight.
Yes.
And so if you really get to that point where you where you begin to realize that we have forgotten the possibility that objects are actually subjects like we are. In other words, that we have subjectivity and an old cottonwood tree spreading its shade over the water is a being.
Yes.
And it has a subjectivity. And, you know, it brought me back to Wordsworth and, you know, that great poem about Tintern Abbey, where he says, you know, that we can see into the heart of things. And I think that is just an immense treasury. In other words, I talked to the people in the workshop Saturday morning, and I said, what is your real wealth? Your real wealth is what you imagine. The experience that you have when your imagination is turned on is another kind of wealth than how we measure by materialist methods.
Well, the materialist methods are all about making everything else an object.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, and it has, you know, I tried to explain that when Rilke says you must change your life, he says that at the end of a poem in which he's taken you through some changes in which you realize that he is resubjectifying the world. He says, there is no thing that does not see you.
Hmm.
You see? And it makes people nervous.
Well, it would.
You know? I mean, it's like, in other words, you mean that cottonwood tree is part of Big Brother? I'm being watched? You know?
Well, I think with the cottonwood tree, it would be sensed.
Yeah, well, the thing is that if you say to yourself that the cottonwood tree has a subjectivity, it's not so easy to bang a nail into it.
No.
You see what I mean? I mean, we blow holes through mountains so we can put railroads through.
Yeah.
Because things are just our playthings. There's no ethical dimension when dealing with things.
No, it's, yeah, it's very much like... You've read Martin Buber a little bit, correct?
Oh, or yeah. Now you mean yeah.
Yeah, sure. This is kind of that territory.
Yep, exactly. And I mean, you know, it has its implications.
No, it's huge implications.
I mean, you think about, you know, some of the things that we learned about in thinking about war. You know? During war, we bomb people and so forth, but before we do that, we dehumanize them.
Yeah, we have to, and we can't think of them as...
Yeah, exactly. So I'm talking about another kind of riches.
Than the ones we have, the ones we define.
Where you truly can love your roses. You know, that you tend during the summer months, and that you care for during the winter, when you cover it up and make sure it doesn't, you know, freeze to death in the snow.
I'm getting a little thirsty for the poetry there, though. I mean, you're getting worked up for. I want to hear about these roses, and the ditch too. Actually, it's walk among the ditch. Walk Among the Ditch is the name of the title of the book, correct?
Yeah, Walks along the ditch.
Walk along the ditch.
Right. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read from the poem, which actually was late in composition.
That happens.
It's called the Larimer Well Ditch. It's about a kind of threshold that you pass. My threshold was pretty obvious. Retirement. I retired and I realized that I had crossed into another stage of life. And that there were certain things that I needed to settle. And the ditch was extremely helpful. So I'm going to read it, okay?
Okay, cool.
The Larimer Well Ditch. You hand in your keys and it's over. 33 years and a gold watch. You walk outside and all is green shade against the immense wrinkles of foothills crowned with blue reflected in water. An hourglass running out so smooth, you wonder if there's time to clear your soul of debris before the ditch rider lowers the sluice gate to release the spring flow. A narrow sparkling in sun and moon split off into a canal that runs on like a sentence to rolling plain, yet pooled where black clouds of catfish spawn, shift shape like a bluebird flock, and flexing and relaxing its soft current caressed by dragonflies in July. It can be walked along and sat beside and read, its surface clawed by clouds that bloom and stretch the earth it lives on. No breeze in still August, yet the water is dimpled with whirlpools like a long row of Sufis spinning light from their balance. Time to open up and let heaven through. You are alone with your memories. Every regret you carry beside this water course, curving in wildflower banks. You walk all afternoon, watching darkness rise to devour the trees, and things go on. Cities of people, their flashes and flaws, the many things they make that own them, the burden of what comes next. Nail guns fasten, wrecking balls swing, nations find provocations for drums. It's a miracle you don't stumble down a bank into the drink. You imagine yourself drawn through a flaming womb, a coffee can filled with your ashes buried by an apple tree with the metal of worthy owls you lusted for, stamped on your memorial bench posthumously. But you are beyond victory or defeat. You are flecks of carbon settling on branches and leaves, lifting and falling in the dark beside a soft trickling from low falls, the ditch as tongue, as film stock, as Milky Way. Time to ponder what is of the earth, what is of the world, what is of heaven. Perhaps the Sumerians learned to write from trenching ditches in the earth with picks and shovels and white-lathered horses. The song of it, a struck tuning fork in the mind that reminds us that change is hard. change takes time.
Wow. I love the tuning fork.
Yeah.
I love that image.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of a Chinese version of the Sartori.
Which, I'm a little ignorant of the Sartori.
In the middle of your meditation, you know. It's like the whole thing about having the patience to pay attention, to find your balance.
Yeah.
And the payoff of the balance is equanimity.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought to myself, a person who has found equanimity within themselves is a lot harder to scare, a lot harder to, you know, to cause panic inside of.
A lot harder to topple.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So that, you know, there are these times when you're doing your exercise and you're doing the forms and the postures and the transitions. And the outer world, the world of politicians and what they say and what they try to get you to do, which is to join the stampede they're trying to create. You know, it's like the basic idea, which is vote for me or it's the end.
Of course. that's a marketing method.
You know.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I mean, and I'm not talking about any particular party either.
No, you know? That's, I mean, that's
a widely used attitude. You know. Run!
That doesn't work as well when people are taking Tai Chi for or practicing equanimity.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and particularly to slow down. But there are bigger things too. Even, you know, I found that one day doing Tai Chi, looking at the mountains, looking at the sky above the mountains, I had a moment in which I knew that I am part of it, that I'm one with it.
You kind of lost yourself for a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it happens.
No, it does.
And I think it's, you know, I think there's another thing, which is, you know, the thought that we are part of a force that creates everything, but we really don't understand it. You know, we live in this continuous mystery, you know? And then you begin to see, you know, the mysterious side of things, you know?
Yeah.
The mystery of attraction. You know, how does that happen? And yet you know it. You know? It's... And we hardly talk about it. We hardly talk about it. So we live in a world of war, you know?
Yeah, well, we do.
Yeah. But, you know, there are times... I've got a poem here called Brief Encounter.
Cool.
And I think it really, you know, I mean, I went out in the winter walking along the ditch. It was largely covered with ice, but, you know, you could still see the water running in kind of like in bubbles under the see-through ice, you know.
Yeah.
But I ran into an animal along the ditch, a wild animal, and you know, I thought it was a fox, but you know, since writing the poem, I really wonder. So I'm going to read it. Okay.
Okay. Cool.
It's called "Brief Encounter." I crunch through crusted snow, west on snowshoes along the ditch. Wing clouds stand pearl white above the foothills, ridged in lodgepole pine, that summers ago blazed orange in swirling dragons from tree to tree. The sky shifts from silence to chartreuse. A breeze in flocked box elders shimmers, flakes down on a hump of crystal, a frosted apparition the size of a yearling sheep. We look at one another a long moment. I can't tell if she's afraid or hungry. What do I look like to her? A walking stump? I turn east where the ditch divides into stubble cornfield. A minute passes before her black nose sticks out from a juniper bush. She must have crossed ice, run behind and past me. Quiet as fog, calm, yet curious about another animal abroad in the same winter, hunting different sustenance. She and I fade inside, blizzard wind so cold, my lips crack. She writes herself in my breath. I hold her. Like part of myself, I hardly ever see.
I thought maybe you, at the end of that, you didn't actually come out and touch the fox. You just, you held her in your mind, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I was engrossed in thought in the poem, and just imagining it. And crossing across the river too, or the ditch, I think would be pretty dangerous for any sizable animal.
Actually, you know, because it was covered with, it seemed like a foot thick.
Oh, so it was thick.
It was about the size of a small sheep. And that's why I wondered what it, you know, that couldn't be a fox.
Chupacabra. No, actually, chupacabras don't look anything like that. Supposedly.
Yeah. You know, it's just, so, you know, that's the kind of thing that I've been working on. I've got another one called The Moment You Hold It.
Okay. Yeah, love to hear it.
Smoke spirals from chimneys across the ditch. The air carries its woody smell down the hill to other houses where small lights shine in the window of an aging couple, learning from the radio that a good story is one of life's most enduring pleasures. And over the frozen water, the wind shapes snowdrifts into angel harps that have fallen from a clear sky where a half moon hangs between Venus and Orion, the place Egyptians believed was the soul's true home. At the edge of a ruined city, two soldiers share a cigarette in an alleyway, waiting for their patrol to catch up. As yet, the night is quiet. No wind stirs the sycamore branches. Not a child is crying. No dogs are barking. This is peace for as long as you can hold it.
No, I can agree with that. That's
you know, in other words, if you're going to have peace, you have to have peace in your heart.
You have to be able to hold it.
And you have to be able to hold it. And that takes patience. And that takes attention. Like maybe you've never practiced before. So this is a, you know, this is a book about developing a consciousness.
It's about developing consciousness or a or about consciousness itself.
Developing a consciousness by placing it in your Tan Tien. In other words, that place beneath your belly button.
Okay.
The place that's halfway between your belly skin and your back skin.
Oh, so like the chakra.
Yeah.
Americanized version of it is probably.
Yeah, they call it the Tan Tien.
Yeah.
Or to translate it, the Sea of Chi. And you put it down there. You take your mind out of your head and you put it in your body. And you think with it. You think with your body.
Yeah.
And you develop a new dimension of your consciousness.
Well,
and that's what I'm kind of writing about in this book.
Well, I mean, the thing to me is that while the brain is the big instrument of the nervous system, there are nerves all over your body.
That's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's sensations at the very least, and that's... I think with Chinese philosophy, I think the mind-body split doesn't, they try to get past it or get past
That's
it.
Right. It's not that it doesn't exist. They know it exists. The question is, what do you do about it?
Yeah.
You know?
And
the thing is, what you were saying, you know, nerve endings throughout your body. I mean, you know, in the history of, you know, like 20th century American poetry, you have Charles Olson, who wrote an essay called Proprioception. And proprioception is the word for the fact that your body is a feedback system. That you know things from the end, you know, the tips of your fingers. You know things through your nose. You can feel the chair under your seat. You know, proprioception.
Yeah.
It's part of perception.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's something we suppress a lot.
Because we're busy getting.
We're busy, you know, we're busy thinking.
Getting and spending, we lay waste our lives.
Well, actually, just to play devil's advocate here, I think getting and spending are almost become unconscious in American society. I don't think we're actually very conscious about it. I think the dichotomy with the feeling in your, you know, the feeling of your seat is you forget about it because you're a bit too busy thinking about other things and your brain is sucking all the energy out.
Hard. Change takes time.
Yes.
In other words, to make your life better, to become a more conscious person is sometimes painful.
No, well, that's pain is something that nerve endings tell you and give you.
That's right. And you know, sometimes in doing the Tai Chi, what you feel is pain, although my teacher makes a distinction between good pain and bad pain. If you do your exercises in such a fashion that you hold a position for a long time,
oh, yeah. No, that's definitely true. Actually, yeah, that's, I forgot that, you know, you have to stand on one foot and eventually kick your foot out and hold that.
Right. That's right.
And then there's snake creeps
along your leg. Yeah.
Yeah, that one's a little hard too.
Snake creeps down your leg. Yeah.
I like that move, but yes, it took a while before I could get that one down.
Yeah, I mean, you have to turn your feet the right way.
Well, that you always have to. That's a lot of turning feet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, it's like I think you come to the realization that it's about the balance all the time. And part of that is that you balance the world with yourself. You know, it's, well, I could just keep reading poems, and you know,
that would be.
Just, I have a kind of a lighter poem, if you'd like.
That would be great. I don't know if we're that like dark right now, but. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a poem called Blue Heron. A flying Z glides silently through the corridor of green shadow made by trees on either bank of the ditch. It flaps its wings 1001, 1002. Its pitch is changed. Its black back flaps open like Fred Astaire's vest on a mirrored floor as he tap dances. Settled, its crest shaken out, the Ichabod steps slow on his stalks with ganglionic clouds like a weaver at her shuttle, then darting his long yellow chopsticks, pulls a wriggling crawfish out, cracking its shell, guzzling the meat down its sink-catch throat. I've watched this every summer for 8 years. It always leaves a claw to share with the earthbound, the energy through its spine, reaching with relaxed feather tips to feel every pulse. Every dance is a dance with gravity.
No, that's.
So, I mean, I even chuckled to myself when I wrote about the long yellow chopsticks.
Oh, the chopsticks! It starts off with the flying Z.
I always have fun with that one. But you know, it's really changed my perspective. I mean, if you start going away, in other words, if you decide that your path is a spiritual path, then all the other stuff, the unconscious consumption that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The unconscious, you know, because you see, it just seems to me, but I could be wrong, that in order to develop a consciousness that isn't about, shall we say, the art of the deal,
yeah,
then it has less and less to do with you. You know, the only problem is that I'm an old liberal, and if I, you know, if I feel like I'm deserting, you know, the fight for a better world, then I feel guilty.
Well, I don't, I think a certain turning inward can be healthy. This is a very different. Perhaps I should explain the listeners out there who didn't hear Magician's Hat that this is a very different work. The Magician's Hat was very much about politics, and it was about an artist who got wrapped up in them. And actually, it was kind of a tragic. In some ways, it was tragic that he had. He got You know, he had to suffer because of that.
He was famous, and because he was famous, the government decided that they had to shut him up.
Yeah, no, it's...
Because he had too much influence.
No, that's... I'm also coming at from... Because I told you on the phone, like, a couple days ago that I just finished reading Machiavelli, which is very different. It's probably more in line with Magician's Hat. I was just thinking of the fact that Tai Chi and Taoism come out of a culture that, while they've had long periods of peace at times, they don't have a long history of Republican government.
Right.
Of the not Republican Party, but Republican government, because that's really what we live in. There have been a couple attempts at true democracy, but Athens lasted for a while, but even then you can quibble and say that there are numbers of people who were not even represented, that the United States is more representative of its own people now than Athens. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of good and value in the Taoism and the in Tai Chi itself. It's just like you know, and being able to balance yourself in relation to the world and the world outside. And that's correct.
Because, you know, I mean, our culture is a culture that, you know, is, how should we say,
rapacious,
extroverted.
It's very extroverted.
And therefore, I mean, connected to that extroversion is the notion that we must do something.
Yeah. No, it's...
Let's warm up into a crusade and go do something.
Yeah, that's... I mean, I think of rapacious as like we're very much... Because also I'm thinking... I'm not quite thinking of Western civilization. I'm thinking of American civilization, and that's... We're kind of like this society that's conquered and pillaged an entire continent. That's basically true.
Right.
And we're not done with it. Culturally, we're kind of exporting our culture everywhere in the world, and it's driving... It's kind of annoying people outside of the American culture. I don't know how annoyed the Chinese are at the moment with us, but you know.
Well.
But other cultures are annoyed, and other cultures have their flaws too. I'm not.
You know, Henry James at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century was, you know, writing novels about Americans in Europe.
Yeah. Well, he. I haven't read enough, but I've read...
And spoiled and demanding and unconsciously insulting.
That I haven't read The Ambassadors. I haven't read a number of the large... I haven't read most of the long works. I have read, believe, Portrait of a Lady?
Yeah.
And I think that one's more presented as the tragedy of the American in Europe as opposed to...
Yeah.
And also the man who could have been, but gave up on her, and he also was a lot of his stuff's about ambiguity.
Yes, but in Portrait of a Lady,
she doesn't behave.
What he invents is the interior monologue.
Oh yeah, no, it's.
There are four sections in that novel, which are just, you know, the lady talking to herself in her boudoir. And, you know, and then James Joyce came along, you know.
Yeah, and picked it up and went onward.
So, you know, I don't know. You want me to read another poem?
That would be great, actually.
You want to talk more? I mean,
I think the
thing I'm trying to understand now is Wu Wei, which is doing by not doing.
Yeah.
And the whole thing with Tai Chi as a martial art, Tai Chi as a martial art is very measured, very, very balanced, very, like proportionate.
Yes.
You know, so that basically what it does is it makes you more supple. And how you fight is you fight by not being there.
What?
You're relaxed, but you're hyper alert.
I think that's, yeah. No, I was just thinking one of the main things is to not go past your balance.
Right, because that's, then you're off balance.
Yeah, which in a way, when you think about it, not all of them, but a number of the martial arts, like Aikido, you are supposedly only able to practice it if someone actually attacks you. You're using other people's energy against them. And with Tai Chi, the idea is that, you know, you don't go past your balance so that you have this area. So if nobody ever encroaches your area, you'll never get into a fight.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, if you go back to, you know, withdraw. Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, you have ward off left, ward off right.
Yes.
Right? And then withdraw.
Yes, and that's, yeah.
Bring your hands to the right. You bring your hands down. Your left hand swings around in a great big circle, and you do press and then push.
Yep, and that's
and
not
that withdraw move is where you arrange not to be there when your opponent attacks you.
Yes. I was just thinking,
what happens is you can win by simply exhausting your opponent.
Oh, that's actually most of the martial arts, I think. I think a lot of them, that's the point, is that you conserve energy as well.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Yeah, well, I think I was talking to you about, you know, having soft feet.
Yes.
I'm reading a book simply called Questions and Answers, and one of the assertions in this book is that as you're doing a standing meditation and you're feeling the soft feet, that just beneath the lowest level of the softness of your feet is an immense internal energy. And when, you know, if you feel like your life is threatened, you can summon that and you can direct it through, let's say, a kick.
Yeah.
And that energy, which is the energy of the earth, right? When in the poem I said, time to think about, you know, the earth and the world, which is a different thing than the earth. The world is our culture. Or lack of.
Yes.
And then there's heaven. And this, I mean, to me, this mystery is, how do you get that energy coming up through your body so that you can do a heel kick and it just saves your life? You know, it's, at any rate, you can see that what I'm talking about a lot is I'm talking about, you know, what you would think. Namely, you're getting older and you're thinking about death.
Yeah. You know? But you're also, I mean, you're coming to terms with the world as well. It isn't just death. It's also like trying to attain a certain peace of mind.
That's right.
Yeah.
They call it Anjin, peace in the heart.
Hmm.
Anjin, with an X, X-I-N.
Yeah.
A-N-X-I-N, two words, Anjin. I have a poem called Anjin, or Seeking Anjin, which is near the end of the book.
Did you want to read that one, or did you have another one you wanted to read?
So here's Seeking Anjin. Bird-shaped milkweed pods release their feathery fluff to the breeze. White haze washes foothills into the shape of an immense whale. Time to breathe before the snow flies, before it takes leaves down to where they gather in the great dark sea as food for creatures still unborn. I lay down by wild asparagus stalks. Their branches have crimson berries like the Chinese character for heart, like an L with drops of blood in the middle and both sides. Unlike all the other characters for organs, it has no radical that says it's of the flesh. It's open to heaven and all the peaceful arts. Its virtue is that it spreads everywhere and brings life. Ditch water spills inside another water that gave birth to water. I am not the one who worries about what may come. I listen to the merging of heaven and earth as it makes poetry in every flaming drop of rain. I shift my weight to feel the mountains sway. Music, light green as the undersides of aspen leaves, brings the heart ease in prayer as spirits enter and depart. This is what I seek. It's it was like I used to be religious when I was a child.
Huh.
And I'm not religious much anymore.
So yeah, that's something that's happened to me too. Kind of.
Yeah. Well, let's just say less so.
Yes.
Here's a poem called Memorial Day, and it's about the culture you spoke of that makes us unconscious.
Yes.
Memorial Day. Muffled drums roll, shoes crunch gravel, a grunting bugle sounds taps. Tassels on the baton twirler's white boots, the high school band in plumes, the parade and its followers. Scouts, parents, veterans form a horseshoe around the bronze Union soldier. Was it true that brother killed brother? Could that ever happen again? The bayonet's spike points only to the sky. The color guard raises its ribboned banners. Aim! A voice in uniform shouts. Worshippers of ultimate sacrifice bow their heads in a requiem of state as eight rifles spit a ragged fire. Ejection shells clink on pea stones. Every scout dives for one, puts it to his lips, splits the air with triumphant shrieks. They will drill holes in them, clip them on gimp lanyards, hang them around their necks as self-awarded trophies of the spent cartridge. Oak leaves drip from morning rain, smear the plaque that tells the regiment's story. 4 score and 7.
7 years ago, the last day of May, partly sunny, yet cannon smoke still drifts toward white crosses and flag stands, lifts strands of people's hair off their foreheads. Dedicated to the proposition, someone reads, I take off my cap like everyone else. That's how, you see what I mean? That's how we become who we are.
Unconscious.
Yeah, because that's what you grew up in. You know, honoring the dead.
Yeah. And, well, you got to seek a balance there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that you know, I'm trying to say, look, this is where I come from. You know?
No, I know, but I was just thinking of that you took your cap off, even though you're, yeah.
Even though you're...
Unconsciously you took your cap off and memorializing the dead, even though you're thinking
not in favor of war.
No.
Yeah, and not only that, but already the fear of the next war.
Yeah.
I'm gonna read one final one, and then that'll be it. Okay.
That sounds great.
Okay. There's a cemetery that has the children of the Native American women who married the mountain men.
Yeah.
The beaver trappers.
Yes.
And it's about 5 miles from where I live. And it's called Bingham Hill Cemetery. Double Greenwood Gates, family name. Provo and Trask and Dion. So many infants' graves saying Mary. One with a lamb chiseled on black stone. A path to the epitaphs. A plain-looking bench. Faced south to scattered hogbacks like wooden bowls filled with mahogany, mountain mahogany, and rabbit brush. Then I felt it, heard it. A calico cat with near black jacket, its fur fringed in orange, its belly white, mewing, rubbing my ankles, urging me with pink tongue to sit as it smeared on my pant legs, its scent. I knew my long-haired tiger at home would smell on me. It led me to a polished headstone which bore chiseled words. If you never daydream and plan with your imagination, you'll never get there. Though born with wings, most never ask why they crawl through life. On my shoulder blades, 2 charred stubs. I tried to walk away without a further thought. The cat would not let me leave. Got its wide body between my legs. When I looked down, it was looking back to the child Ezra's place, his gravestone's other side with birth and death dates. Ezra, almost 11, in a south-facing plot where the sun would blind the living if not for this cat.
Hmm.
So those are among the things that are in this book.
Walks among ditches, among the ditch.
Along, A L O N G.
Oh, sorry. Walk along the ditch.
Yeah, walks.
And our guest tonight has been Bill Tremblay from Colorado. And I'd like to thank you for coming on.
Oh, hey, You know, as I told you before, I love coming on because we always have fun together, and I think that we are kindred spirits.
I think there's a lot of kindred spirit there, yes. There probably is a Chinese word for it. I just don't know right now.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, but they do have a word for spirit, and the word is Shen. S-H-E-N.
Well, so you've been listening to Talking Earth, and this is KBO Portland, 90.7 in your FM dial. Please.
KBO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the film screening Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, on Friday, October 21 at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Since then, he has not stopped calling attention to the endless illegal wars being waged by the United States. Again, that's Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, on Friday, October 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud